Professor Fletcher, I'd like to thank you for your interest in the inquiry and for your appearance at today's hearing. The purpose of this hearing is to assist me in gathering evidence for the Climate Health WA inquiry into the impacts of climate change on health in Western Australia. My name is Tarun Wiramantri, and I've been appointed by the Chief Health Officer to undertake the inquiry. Beside me is Dr. Sarah Joyce, the inquiry's project director. If everyone could please be aware that the use of mobile phones and other recording devices is not permitted in this room, and please make sure that your phone is on silent or switched off. This hearing is a formal procedure convened under Section 231 of the Public Health Act 2016. While you are not being asked to give your evidence under oath or affirmation, it is important you understand that there are penalties under the Act for knowingly providing a response or information that is false or misleading. This is a public hearing, and a transcript of your evidence will be made for the public record. If you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that that part of your evidence be taken in private. You have previously been provided with the inquiry's terms of reference and information on giving evidence to the inquiry. Before we begin, do you have any questions about today's hearing?
None at all.
For the transcript, could I ask you to state your name and the capacity in which you are here today?
It's David Fletcher. I'm here as Chair of the Professional Development at the College of Surgeons. I'm also, Chair of the Sustainability Working Party for the College, which has been established. I guess I also represent my institution, which is Fiona Stanley Care Mental Hospital Group, where I'm the co-lead surgeon, and I'm the head of the Department of General Surgery.
Thank you, Professor Fletcher. Would you like to make a brief opening statement?
Look, I must say I'm really pleased that, that this opportunity has actually come, because I think from my point of view, pollution is a core business of healthcare. And if we look at the campaigns that were done actually about tobacco and asbestos in the past, I think healthcare in the state excelled itself. But there is the additional problem of waste, of which healthcare is a major contributor. And we know that the Victorian and New Zealand governments are actually actively working in this area. And I do note that the other states actually have climate change policies, which I gather we are in the process of developing, and very happy to be part of that process. A lot of local initiatives are going on, actually, in institutions, but this is really not enough. Okay, we really need to actually combine the bottom-up and the top-down at the same time. So we need integration and we need direction. So from my view, actually, this is a wicked systems issue, because it goes way beyond health and the idea of actually having involvement of other sections of the government is important, because we know that housing and energy and sanitation and so on actually are major players. And the clinical care itself only contributes 16% to the well-being of individuals. But I also see this as a justice issue and an intergenerational issue as well. It's going to affect actually subgroups, climate change. It's going to affect particularly the poor, the rural, and people in Indigenous areas. It's going to affect our descendants, which is really what bothers me. So what we need actually is an agreed evidence-based framework, which has to be based upon research, and we need to do research of our own, not just depend on everybody else's. And this research needs to include actually health economics and health outcomes. We need to have measures that, of what is happening, because if we don't measure it, we can't manage it. And we need benchmarks for performance against which we have to test ourselves. And a great example of this actually is the NHS Sustainable Development Unit, chaired by David Pension. Interestingly, David Pension will be in Australia next year. I forgot to mention I'm also chair of the surgical director section of the college. And he's our guest next year at the Annual Scientific Congress. And they meet for this meeting in Perth, and they've actually pensioned him as well. So he'll be here. It would be great to actually use him when he's here next year in May. So you had a series of questions for me. I'll respond to how I can.
And thank you very much for your written submission to the inquiry, which we found very helpful. And I note the 2018 Royal Australasian College of Surgeons position paper on the environmental impact of surgical practice. It has been estimated by Malik and others in the journal Lancet Planetary Health in 2018 that the healthcare sector is responsible for 7% of Australia's total greenhouse gas emissions, and that hospitals account for half those healthcare sector emissions. Can you further break that hospital figure down and give us an estimate of the contribution of surgical practice?
Okay, it's the evidence is limited, and that's the problem. Okay, and that's what we need to do something about. In this state, we don't have our own data at all. I've relied to a certain extent on the Western Hospital, which is in Footscray, and they've been at this for quite some time. One of their leaders there is an anaesthetist for McGain, who's actually done research actually in this area, which he's published. So they do have some data. The figure of 7% reduction by health is a figure that comes from a number of other sources as well. There's a company, that's his name, Quacky 2010. And their estimate actually is that half of the healthcare pollution actually comes from hospitals. And surgery contributes to a fair proportion of that, surgery and anaesthesia. In terms of rubbish production, for example, we account for about 30% of the refuse that's actually produced. Our figure of 7% is probably better than the US, where the estimate actually is between 8 and 10%. But it's a lot worse than what happens in the UK, where in fact their figure is about 4%. And that's decreased by 11% since 2008. And that probably is a direct result actually of the UK Climate Change Act, which has actually started measuring and developing benchmarks. Their estimate is that they've saved $160 million a year ongoing. So people often see this as an expense, but in reality, it's going to be a saving once you get going. In terms of energy, if you look at Western Health, for example, they've put in solar panels and they've converted their lights and halogen to LED. And turning off things like theatres are not being used, their estimate is that they've saved $300,000 from that process. And they say that's enough energy to run one small suburb for one entire year by that sort of activity. So what we really need, actually, I think, is a sustainability development unit like the UK, but to have one actually in WA. So in answer to your question, actually, the figures are a bit rubbery, but those estimates are pretty reasonable. And surgery and anaesthesia is a major player.
Can you provide a picture of an operating theatre and why it's such, an intense place for generating emissions?
Yeah, well, there's two components to it, actually. Yeah, if you look at the emissions, it depends a lot on the anaesthetics that are used, actually. So CO2 itself actually is obviously a pollutant, but the really damaging ones are things like desflurane, okay, and nitrous oxide. Desflurane is about 1,000 times more potent in terms of its damage, okay, and it's a convenient inhalational anaesthetic unit that you can actually use. But it does a great deal of damage. Are there alternatives? Well, there are. You can actually use less toxic inhalational agents, but you can also use total intravenous anaesthesia, which is a little more complex, and it does actually have downsides of its own. So that's using propofol by ongoing infusion. Propofol itself, actually, if you have excess of that, that is actually difficult to get rid of. Because also it does damage. So it's a matter of making sure that there isn't excess left. It's also the question of the number of syringes that you would use to actually deliver the drug. So if there's recycling of syringes, that becomes no less of an issue. But there's an estimate actually that you would save around about $30,000 a year in one theatre by converting over to total intravenous anaesthesia, and that you would actually save the greenhouse gas equivalent for one operating theatre for 1 year, the equivalent to about 37 return jumbo flights to the UK and back. So the impact actually is quite substantial. Yes, there are options, but it's a matter of actually education, so people understand actually what they're using and what the implications of it are.
Thank you. So we've been provided with a summary of what Western Health are doing to reduce their use of those particular anaesthetic gases.
Yep.
So that's one hospital in one state?
Yep.
Are you aware from your role with the college about whether such activities are more widespread than that? And is there any data, for example, from Western Australia, which looks at an audit of anaesthetic gas use here?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of, actually. I know that Charles Gardner, for example, had been active for a year now. They did a presentation last year, actually, when we were talking about sustainability. So they're worth approaching. And I do know that at my own hospital, that we have the Greening Theatre Initiative. So Adam Crossley and Jennifer Liddell have been leading that. And they have education programs constantly with their department meetings about how we need to reduce the use of these particular agents. The Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane has been particularly active. And if you look at War on Waste, they had actually had a program directly from that hospital. And what they're doing is really quite outstanding. In addition, they're doing things like actually using their food waste, turning into compost, and their excess water. They're actually greening the environment by actually having plants growing in the hospital, which is good to look at. And is also saving waste as well. So there are lots of initiatives that can actually be done beyond just the anaesthetic gases.
Can you identify any particular characteristics of health services that are taking the lead?
I think it boils down to actually to enthusiasts, because at the moment there isn't the guidance and the direction which comes from above people to work to. So I think we read the literature, we understand the implications of what's happening actually, and we make the decision to do something about it ourselves, to take personal responsibility for it. I gave a talk in May this year to international colleges in Bangkok, which is where that material I gave you actually came from. And the way I put it to them actually is, that it is each one of us, it's our responsibility. And to ignore the need to make change, actually, if we do it out of ignorance, I guess we can accept that to a degree. But to do it actually out of, to be perverse, or actually for getting a return, whether it be financial in some form or another by associations with the industry or something else, actually is really totally unacceptable. And we have a responsibility to do something. Okay, the time is actually now.
So now can I ask you about the role of professional colleges?
Yeah.
And we've asked the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons to come today. We haven't asked all of the professional colleges, because you do have a position statement and you've made a submission to the inquiry, and surgery and theatre is obviously a major part of the picture. But so specifically, if you're talking about leading institutions, leading individuals who've got a particular interest, driving change, what has the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons done as a leader in surgical education? And how have you worked with them, and how can you see that going?
Okay, so on College Council, actually, since 2015, it was initiated by Professor David Waters, who developed a program actually for us to be examining issues about the sustainability of healthcare in general. That sustainability was one really about actually preserving the healthcare system, and it had a lot to do with the financial implications of both the public and the private sector. So I was a member of that committee, and what we did was to use data from private insurance companies, for example, to feed back to individual clinicians about what their activity was and what they were charging, because one of our real concerns actually is excess fees. And the college has been pretty active in the media over a particular neurosurgeon on the other side of the country whose behaviour we find totally unacceptable. So there's a sustainability of healthcare. We've just established a sustainability of environment, which I'm the interim chair. So we have guidelines of practice which we've sent you. What we've also done actually is developed a new competency framework. So the college actually has 9 competencies. CAMBEDS is based on, it's got 7. We've added a couple of others actually, which is judgment and technical ability. But we've also just added now to that actually cultural competency to make 10. Okay, but within that, those competencies, we redefined them. And for example, on the competency health advocacy, we've got response to the social determinants of health, okay, and is aware of what those determinants actually are. So we actually have the potential to examine candidates on that. It's now actually in the framework, so they need to understand it. Second, actually, is to demonstrate a commitment to the sustainability of healthcare systems by giving due consideration to the financial and environmental effects related to healthcare sustainability. So that's now written into our curriculum framework, and therefore it is examinable. Okay, the initiatives have also done very similar things, actually. I was trying to find where I wrote it down, actually. Here it is, actually. They got ANSCA, it's called PS640, and the initiatives have a role to play in the mitigating of climate change and environmental degradation. And it goes on from there about how to actually go about doing that. So within their college, similarly, I understand the College of Physicians is actually doing something similar. But anaesthesia and surgery, we see we have the biggest impact. So therefore, we have the biggest responsibility to do something.
That's very helpful. So embedding those changes into new competency frameworks will obviously affect the training and the awareness of people when they come out as consultant surgeons. So can I ask, when did you first get interested in this as an issue as in terms of your surgical practice? And given I presume you've been interested for some years, given your background, and what's your observations about younger surgeons versus more established surgeons and their level of awareness, interest and willingness to address this issue?
Yeah, I think actually the rate of change in understanding is accelerating at an enormous rate. And I think the younger generation actually get it a lot more than the older generation. I think the great model actually we can base ourselves upon actually is the children protesting. Okay, they're the ones that have got the most to lose. So I guess the younger generation who appreciate it more. But just standing back and watching it, I just think the rate of change is now becoming dramatic. How long have I been interested? I can't put a date on it actually, but it's a long time. Okay, concerns about social justice, always have. Okay, so this is probably one of the areas in which I have interest. Things like refugees and all sorts of other things as well. Okay, and I think that's just an individual thing. Is the college interested in those? Yes, it is. Is it outspoken as it should be? My personal view is no, it's not, even though I sit on council and try and make it. So.
But you're part of a process of change, including in professional colleges.
Yeah. Well, for example, the Younger Fellows Forum, we have representation on college council from fellows who've actually had a fellowship for less than 10 years. And they're incredibly active as a group. And a lot of the change is actually being driven from them. They have forums every year, and it's actually one of the topics that's constantly there. On college council, we also have what's called the RACs of representatives. That's the surgical trainees, and they are major voices in this particular area as well. So the older generation is actually being pushed to actually do something, and the drive is coming from the younger ones. There's no question about that.
You may not be able to answer this question, but this is a West Australian inquiry.
Sure.
Yeah, are there any observations you'd like to make about the level of awareness or action in Western Australia compared to other states or jurisdictions?
Yeah, well, I must say, actually, the previous president of the WA State Committee, a guy called Steve Rodriguez, who's an ENT surgeon, he introduced the question, actually, about ethical purchasing, which I thought was incredibly good, and that's something we're going to build into the Sustainability Committee. Now, we do not want to be buying equipment from people who are using slave labour. And if you look at the requirements of company directors nowadays, they have a responsibility to ensure that their purchasing does not go down that path, that they will not purchase from anybody who actually uses slave labour. And you have a responsibility to look for it, not just to pretend you don't see. But the Australian Institute of Company Directors has made that one of their policies, and I applaud it.
And we did talk in the hearing previously with the health support services about supply chains and procurement. So point you make is noted. Thank you. Just returning to the specifics of hospitals and waste, the inquiry discussed the issue of environmental waste in hospitals 2 weeks ago with another witness, and the importance of segregation was emphasised. And your written submission references some studies suggesting that up to 92% of a hospital's biohazard waste may be non-hazardous. We hadn't seen that figure before.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that and what might be achievable in hospitals to reduce that figure?
Yeah. How much of it is that the case, actually? It would vary enormously between institutions. I think the problem really is you know, about how you define actually what is biohazard. And then do actually individuals actually who are actually working in a theatre environment, do they understand actually what that's a biohazard and what isn't? And the answer is generally not. So what we need to be able to do is to actually make it, to educate people and also to make it easier for them to fulfil their obligation about where they put things. So the Western Hospital, for example, have got very clearly marked bins as to when what goes into each. For example, actually, you know, a biohazard, to get rid of that as compared to a non-hazardous, it's 8 times more expensive. Okay, it's $963 as compared to $126 a tonne. So we waste a lot of money in dealing with it. We probably actually produce a lot of pollution by burning it. So there is obviously not a need, if we appropriately segregated it in the first place. Now, to do that, you know, we need to make it easy for staff. And for example, the figures from the Western Hospital, what did they say? They said 237 operations, which my hospital we do in a couple of weeks, produces 1.265 tonnes of waste. 32% of that's actually infective, 23% is recyclable, and the rest is actually general. It's a matter of segregating that in the first place. So people need to understand actually what the difference actually is, have clearly defined actually rules about it. Can you make changes? Well, greening the theatres, if you understand, he actually has. They've actually reduced the amount of waste which is not recycled over the past 3 years. So I've got a figure here somewhere. Here it is actually. They've increased their recycling from 160 to 196 tonnes over a 3 year period. Okay. So just making the effort, educating people actually will have an impact. That needs to be more widespread. But unless we've got an overarching, policy, people aren't going to necessarily listen. The enthusiasts will do something, but we need to drive everybody actually in the same direction. And that really means an overarching framework and research. What are our figures here? Well, we don't really know. Now, I say I get real enjoyment actually about seeing a benchmark figure actually improving over time. As a head of department, that gives me jollies. We should be doing the same here. We need to measure it to know what we're doing.
You've just said that it is possible to make a difference to that, the correct allocation of waste,
yes,
separation of waste, and that there are initiatives in place in Western Australia at your hospital. But also the figure you quote in terms of the cost, somewhere around $800 for clinical waste versus $100 for non-clinical, that is such a stark comparison. You'd imagine the economics of education would be well worth the investment, and even from a straight economic point of view, that's an easy investment and decision to make.
Yeah, well, I think actually, you know, if we talk about things costing more, and if we come to talking about reusables versus recyclables, there is an issue there about cost. But at the end of the day, I think actually if we drive this correctly, we will save money. The UK has demonstrated that.
And that's only a good example, thank you. Hospitals use a lot of single-use disposable products.
Yeah.
Many, but not all of them, plastic. Is this to reduce the chance of infection, or is it a cost issue? And if it's the former, the chance of infection, is the response proportionate to the risk of infection? And if the latter, should upfront cost be the sole criteria?
Very good question. I must say that just recently I was gobsmacked to understand actually that blood pressure cuffs are thrown out. Tourniquets actually was coming in a nice little pack, you know, for with the little plastic around them. Tourniquet actually goes on, put a needle and syringe in there actually to put your line in, chuck the whole lot away at the end of it, tourniquet included. And I understood recently actually because I started inquiring, pulse oximeters, after each patient, gone. I was led to the question of saying, well, why? Where is your evidence, in fact, that this is a particular risk? And does it outweigh the cost of actually sterilising or cleaning it? And are there techniques available to do so? We don't really know. The evidence is not there, actually. So many of us ask the question, what is the risk and what is the cost of the alternative? And of course we don't know. It just gets chucked out. That's extraordinarily expensive. The figure I've seen actually for disposable instruments in theatre amounts to something like about $40 million a year. It's an extraordinary figure, depending how big your institution actually is. A lot of material we do use is single use, and you can't help that actually. Things like stapling devices, for example, for joining in a bowel together. Some of it can be reprocessed, and should be. Here's the problem with industry, though. When we started laparoscopic surgery back in the 90s, I got involved repeatedly with government and with industry about what we wanted in terms of equipment. What I said to the manufacturers was I wanted reusable equipment. I didn't want all this stuff actually being thrown out. It was not in the interest of the companies to do that, because where their profit came from. It was very clearly about providing instrumentation. And what were the risks actually of reprocessing thin instruments, for example, we've got to wash them out. That takes a little bit of effort. But our request was that they should all be done that way, and the response of the company was, you represent 1% of the market, get lost. And that was the reality at that time. So I've been a very keen advocate for reuse. As I say, some of it you can't, but much of it you can. And we need to have evidence to say which is the most appropriate. I'll give you an example, is that the health department, what's it spend? It spends, not so much spent, but they actually purchase 81 million gloves per year. To my mind, that's totally appropriate because that is an infection and no risk. So there is no alternative to that. How you process those afterwards is going to be the question to get rid of them. But in terms of drapes and gowns, nappies and all those sorts of things, 42.2 million per year the health department purchases. Whereas the evidence that actually using drapes and sending into a laundry afterwards, including gowns, was a problem. The transition occurred many years ago, it sort of happened. And so at the time I was thinking, well, what's the point of this? But it was never really discussed. The evidence I've never actually seen. I'd like to see it. Prove to me, in fact, that it is a risk. And do we have to actually have some upfront cost to deal with these things and reprocessing them? Maybe we do. But that may be the investment we have to make to turn around the damage that we're actually doing. What else was there? The interoperative instruments I've spoken about. So we need to have at the table the companies to discuss with them actually what the realities actually are. And I think in any sustainability committee that we establish, which is what I'll be recommending for each institution, would be that we have, you know, the purchasing officers sitting at the table as well, as well as infection control. And we have the potential to do research about some of these questions, so we can actually answer them in a logical, reasonable way. At the moment, I don't believe we are.
That leads on nicely to the next question about opportunities to try in Western Australia new and innovative practices that do reduce environmental impact and or costs and or improve patient safety.
Yep.
So given what you know about how clinical research and evaluation is set up in Western Australia, how could such research and evaluation directed at those kinds of issues be supported or better supported?
Yeah, well, obviously you need a research fund to back it. It's interesting, you know, Forbes McGain actually, as I say, the next is to Western. He's done, I believe, a PhD based simply on environmental research. So the opportunity is enormous for the sort of work to be done. Funding becomes an issue with any research, you know, that's always the question. If I think government established a sustainability framework and built into it actually a research base like the NHS has actually done, so that we can ask questions and we can actually get people to answer them, then we will generate research activity, which I think is essential for any clinician to be able to do and for the juniors to be able to do, plus answer some important questions. So yes, there needs to be a framework, there needs to be a funding basis for actually doing it, allocating funds based upon on merit. So there are other opportunities, I know, in terms of obtaining research funding, but that's always short to come by. But really what I'm looking for actually is just to have an overarching framework which is research-based, and within each institution to have their own sustainability committee represented by those that are involved. What the Western has succeeded in doing so much is because they had a sustainability officer whose job was, I think it was about 0.6, to work within the institution to drive it along and to make sure that that everybody played their part and to drive the executive. What's interesting, the executive actually has, they've got a committee, they've got environmental policy, they've got a management roadmap, which they actually measure their performance. They can tell you actually what their water usage is, they can tell you what the CO2 production actually is. We can't. So they've gone to the trouble of doing that, to examine their energy production by year. They've got local action plans, and what they do is they encourage green champions. All that's happening at the moment in WA is we've got green champions going around actually doing the best they can, but they're not going to succeed without support. And that's really why I'm here.
And you mentioned this in your submission as well, pointing to these initiatives elsewhere where you do have sustainability committees, sustainability plans, and sustainability officers to support clinical leaders, is that correct?
So correct.
There are elements there already.
Already happening, but we need to integrate it. You asked a question about green in the operating room. This is what it is actually. It's like a self-help group who it's based in the US. It's called Greening the OR. Okay, so it's www.greeningtheor.org. Okay, is the reference to it. What it gives you actually is the thing that you need to do to actually succeed in greening the OR. So it talks about things like, and it's a checklist and you've got to check it off and to compare yourself with other organisations. Do you separate non-infectious waste, for example? Do you segregate pharmaceutical waste? Do you purchase reprocessed medical devices? Okay, do you replace disposable items with reusable items when it's safe to do so? And very one pertinent, actually, do you reuse pulse oximeter probes, which we throw out? reusable gowns for surgical staff, etc. So it's a whole series of questions that you can compare yourself to other organisations to see how you're performing. So very useful. There's a whole pile of different websites which I included actually on my submission originally.
So the inquiry will make a set of recommendations, and given that, let's say, those recommendations were accepted and government wishes to move forward in partnership, and clearly everyone has a different role in this process. You reflect a bit on you're here to represent the College of Surgeons.
Yep.
Those are national colleges, all these, they're quite august bodies, the Royal Australasian College of this and that medical or surgical specialty, of which the College of Surgeons is one. But how could they work at a state level together to support any framework or initiative that government wishes to propose?
Okay, I would not see that as a problem for the surgeons in particular. As I say, the policies which are developed at the council level are passed down to the state committees. And once a year, each of the state committees has the option or the opportunity of coming to actual council. So they understand what's actually being proposed. My role, actually, as a councillor, I represent all general surgeons in Australia and New Zealand. For my specialty, there's something like about six subspecialties within that. So before each council meeting, what I do is I write to them all and say, what issues do you want to bring up? Okay. And at the end of the meeting, actually, and I tell them, in fact, what actually happened. And included in that, actually, is sustainability. Okay, so I do the same thing with my state committee. So I sit on the state committee of the College of Surgeons. So sustainability is something they're totally aware of. And as I say, actually, they're developing the initiative themselves, actually, about ethical purchasing. So that fits into the same framework. So it would not be difficult to recruit the specialists into it, the surgeons. And I know the anaesthetists are actually very similar. But they actually have their own policies saying the responsibility of the anaesthetist. So it's not going to be an issue.
Has there been any discussion that you're aware of for the colleges to upskill their... So you talked about training future surgeons. What about upskilling current surgeons in these issues? Is there any initiatives underway?
Yep, so the group that I'm chairing is just getting underway. What we are developing is a repository of approaches, techniques, ideas actually to be kept actually at centrally, which we would then actually divulge to anybody who actually wishes to take part. Plus, also because I chair the surgical directors of the college, so they're the people actually who are heads of department, heads of divisions, etc. around Australia and New Zealand. We actually send the same sort of information to them. They're the managers. Okay? They're the ones that can actually make the biggest difference most rapidly. So it's got to be at an individual surgeon level, those established already, plus heads of department, plus all the juniors. So it is a wide and sort of approach to actually get this change going.
So my last question is about the link between the clinical staff and return patients beyond the family hospital, the clinical staff, clinical leaders, and the non-clinical, critical key people in this area. It's not just management and executives, but also facility managers, for example.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to just discuss kind of how you operate, how you interact with them on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis inside a hospital?
Until now, very little, but suddenly, it's all suddenly happened. We find that Serco, for example, who are the service providers, and if you understand, they have been incredibly active in their own part for quite some time. Okay, and that submission that I sent to you, I actually sent to the area health executive of South Metro, and they're extremely enthusiastic. And suddenly I found actually that all this activity was going on at multiple levels that I was totally unaware of. Okay, and what it required was integration. So we've agreed, if you understand, with Fremantle, that we will have a sustainability committee that will be widely represented at the end of next year, including the service delivery people in Serco. And that we're looking at the option of actually finding some savings to appoint a sustainability officer. So suddenly, within a matter of weeks, it's just taken off. That's why I remain actually incredibly optimistic. We're just one organisation.
I think that's a great place to finish, Professor Fletcher. Thank you very much for your attendance at today's hearing. A transcript of this hearing will be sent to you so that you can correct minor factual errors before it is placed on the public record. If you could please return the transcript within 10 working days of the date of the covering letter or email, otherwise it will be deemed to be correct. There were probably a few technical statements you made that will require you to tell us exactly the right spelling, etc. That's okay. While you cannot amend your evidence, if you would like to explain particular points in more detail or present further information, you can provide this as an addition to your submission to the inquiry when you return the transcript. So I would note you've given us a very good submission and further materials by email, which we thank you for. Thank you for the time attending today.
I greatly appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.